Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 30th Monday. I want to thank the dedicated KBOO staff who have, for these last weeks, kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. It's a big shout-out from the Old Mole Collective. Thank you. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith on ocean pollution and all the dangerous stuff that our out-of-control economic systems are pouring into our land, waters, and atmosphere. Dr. Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith is the International Pollutants Elimination Network Senior Policy Advisor, a community advocate, and long-term campaigner for a toxic-free future. Sarah Summerhill, Old Mole intern from Washington State University, Vancouver, reflects on the intersectionality between the coronavirus pandemic and the climate change emergency. Quote, as the increasing need for social distancing uproots life and society as we know it, we ask ourselves about the positive aspects of these changes on disruptive, destructive systems, and use this time as an opportunity to find a new and creative way to come together. Johanna Brenner interviews Catherine Sammy in our final segment this morning about her recently published book, Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. Catherine Sammy is Assistant Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of California, Irvine. Both Catherine and Johanna Brenner have a long history with the Old Mole Collective as members and contributors. We are excited to have them both back on the show today. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith.
Hello, Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith. Welcome to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, USA.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith got her PhD from the University of Technology in Australia. Over the years, she developed expertise in toxics and toxic waste management. She served on the UN Expert Group on Climate Change and Chemicals and co-author of the report Climate Change and POPs, Predicting the Impact. A POP is a persistent organic pollutant. Sometimes they're called forever chemicals. They just keep accumulating at higher and higher levels. And she's a senior advisor to the National Toxic Network in Australia and other organizations. We're going to discuss pollution, all the dangerous stuff that our out-of-control economic systems are pouring into our land, waters, and atmosphere. These include, of course, the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane causing climate change, as well as many novel molecules, medicines, catalysts, pesticides, additives, flame retardants, on and on, all of this stuff, many synthesized by chemical engineers. And all these chemicals are circulating near everywhere in Earth now in some concentration. And yet, like the POPs, the persistent organic pollution, there really isn't careful research on their toxicity and much less their possible interaction effects. Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith, the engineers, particularly the sewage engineers, once had this quip: the solution to pollution is dilution. Well, that day is gone, and we have to find some real solutions, and soon. You've, though, intensely examined pollution in oceans and its various effects, including on climate change.
Sure. Well, in 2018, we authored the Oceans Pollutant Guide, which looked at the range of pollutants affecting our oceans and affecting our waterways, and how those pollutants interact with the damage that climate change is doing to our aquatic ecosystems. And I think you touched on them in your introduction, but one of the ones, of course, we are most concerned about is the acidification of the oceans. Our oceans are now 26% more acidic than they were 100 or so years ago, and that's having a phenomenal effect on everything from our mollusks and our crabs, even to the way fish spawn. We've got problems with climate change increasing the mobilization of chemicals like POPs, as you described, the persistent organic pollutants, and others, which are called persistent bioaccumulative toxins. So these are just very serious toxins, which are also incredibly persistent. And what's happening is with the heating of the oceans, we're seeing a number of these being released from what we call the environmental sinks, from the ice and the snow. And not only does that just mean more exposure to both marine mammals and marine animals and humans to these chemicals, but the increased salinity, the increased heat, all affect the way chemicals degrade, their bioavailability, the way they build up in our bodies, even our sensitivity to them. And in response, we see that chemical exposure can affect the heat tolerance in fish. So fish that are in streams that are getting warmer and hotter are much, much less tolerant of the toxics they're exposed to. So we have this incredible sort of synergy between these two things: ever-increasing global pollution, particularly in our oceans, which we've treated as a global sump for so many years, and ever-increasing climate change. And it really is doing some pretty terrible things to our aquatic and our eco-marine systems.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the warming of the oceans. Everything's getting hotter, and there's a buildup of CO2 in the oceans. Does that present a threat of greenhouse gases boiling out, which apparently they are in under the Arctic shelf or in Siberia? What are the threats of ocean warming on climate change itself?
Well, certainly the oceans are rapidly heating, much faster than the atmosphere. And in the last 30 years, they've heated about 4.5 times faster than they did in the previous 30 years. And you're right, it's the increased heating, the increased CO2 which goes into the ocean and making it so much more acidic, with the salinity levels going up because of the increased heating, oxygen levels going down, which means you have more dead zones, more marine algae blooms. You're really creating a shocking situation for species who are already under risk from all of the pollutants they're exposed to. And so, you know, our concerns when it comes to chemicals with global warming is very much that increased mobilization, because we're seeing now chemicals like PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls, which are an old-fashioned sort of chemical. Most countries have banned them for many years. We're seeing those levels starting to increase in Antarctic fish and in some parts of the Arctic. Now, we don't think it's because people are using PCBs. We believe it's because they are being increasingly mobilized from ice, snow, sediments. The issue to do with the methane, which is literally escaping from the earth because of the increased temperatures and the melting of the permafrost, that is simply another added factor to the heating of both the atmosphere and the ocean. And while methane is not a toxic chemical as such, it increases global warming, it increases climate change with all of those subsequent impacts. And certainly most people would know now in Australia, we have just had the worst summer ever with fires that have burnt millions of hectares, and most of that has been put down to the increased risk of climate change. So all in all, it's a pretty terrible situation.
Well, what can be done? You know, there's a whole set of solutions, it seems to me, that our elites are completely avoiding. That scientists say if we really take them, if we reconstruct our economy, and there's a good reason that they're not taking it, because they would lose a great deal of wealth and power if we implemented those solutions. But how do we reduce the greenhouse gas emissions and therefore reduce global warming and ocean acidification and all of the impacts that it has?
Well, certainly there is only one solution, and that is the decarbonizing of our economies, which means the removal of fossil fuels and certainly the removal of coal-burning power stations. That, for us, is a major issue, not only because coal is probably one of the biggest contributors to the greenhouse effect and to greenhouse gases, but it's also one of the biggest contributors to mercury. And as most of your listeners would know, mercury is a pretty toxic chemical, and we are now seeing mercury levels increasing. There's been some discussion about them doubling in the North Pacific by 2050. So the good part is that if you attack the issue of coal burning levels increasing, there's been some discussion about them doubling in the North Pacific by 2050. So the good part is that if you attack the issue of coal burning for climate reasons, you also succeed in reducing your toxic exposure. So there's many things we can do to reduce climate change. Whether industries will permit that, whether governments will have the gall to do it, we're at a loss to know. But at the same time, we are going to have to deal with what is here already and the effect that it is having on ocean pollutants now. And we really, as a community, have to change the way we live and change the way we use chemicals, change the way we think about things like plastics, because we have got an awful lot of cleanup that we are going to have to do before we see the benefits of a cleaner ocean and a healthier ecosystem.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio, talking to Marianne Lloyd-Smith on pollution and its impacts. Marianne Lloyd-Smith developed expertise. She's been on UN panels on climate change and the oceans. Marianne Lloyd, tell us about the different sources of ocean pollution.
Yes, well, as I mentioned, we really do use our ocean as a major global sump, collecting all of our rubbish and our chemicals. And, you know, 80% of that originates on land, from everything from industrial releases to water treatment effluent to mining wastes and, of course, agricultural runoff. And these sort of contaminants get into the ocean via atmospheric transport. That simply means just moving through the air, or runoff into waterways, or even often the case of direct disposal or dumping. One of the chemicals that we are most concerned about are one of those POPs, forever chemicals you mentioned earlier, which are the per or polyfluoroalkyl substances, often known as PFAS or forever chemicals. And some studies that were done quite recently on the surface sea surface microlayer, which is the sort of very top part of the ocean, which is a crucial habitat for fish eggs and larvae of lots of species, including our commercial fisheries, PFAS were contaminating 80% of those surface seawater samples. As well as PFAS, we have everything from the brominated flame retardants, which have been used for years to treat furnishings, you know, mercury and heavy metal compounds as well. Lots of the nonyl phenol surfactants and detergents which are breakdowns of a non-arsenal ethoxylate type chemical. And of course, the oceans and our waterways are besieged by pesticides as well. But one of the real ones that surprised us when we did our work was the level of pharmaceuticals that we found in water. And one figure that I must admit just stunned me was when we looked at something like the Baltic Sea and realized that in that, one pharmaceutical alone that's used to treat epilepsy, there was estimated 55 tons of that was actually in the Baltic Sea and in its sediment. So you can imagine that sort of damage, the damage that those pharmaceuticals can do to wildlife. And so many of the pollutants that we see now are what are called endocrine disrupting chemicals. And those are chemicals that disrupt not only the way species reproduce, but the way they behave, even their immune system. And then, you know, not to be too depressing about it, as well as all of these chemical pollutants, you have this massive amount of microplastics moving into the oceans. And I think it was estimated recently by the UN that 13 million tons of plastic waste enters our oceans every year. And that plastic waste, it carries not only the chemicals that the actual plastic was made out of or had added to it, like phthalates and BPA, but all of the chemicals that it concentrates once it's in the water, because it attracts those same POPs chemicals we've been talking about. So when, for an example, a turtle eats a small amount of microplastics, it also eats the PCBs that have found its way onto those plastics. And we have clear indication of that positive correlation, the amount of plastic ingested by ocean species and the amount of contaminants in them. So it is a pretty grim story when you look at the situation of chemicals and plastics in our oceans today.
Yeah. And in fact, in all waters, I've read about the reproductive problems of amphibians, frogs, and others, and the amount now of fish that are unable to reproduce because their reproductive organs are just not capable of creating the sort of the natural cycle. And frogs are just disappearing fairly rapidly all over the world, is my understanding.
Certainly, and what we do see is fish or amphibian species that live downstream to wastewater outfalls, and by those I just mean the outfalls from your local municipal sewage plants that usually pump out their effluent into the closest waterway once it's treated. When we look at male fish downstream of those, we see that they have been feminized, the male fish, and have things like the early stage eggs actually forming in their testes, which, as you say, makes it impossible for them to breed. And this we're seeing, you know, with amphibians and fish in freshwater. We're seeing it in coastal fish, coastal waters close to rivers that are running off agricultural land. So it is an extremely worrying situation when it comes to endocrine disruptions and marine life. And really it is up to all of us, as well as our governments, to get rid of those pesticides that we know are susceptible to causing these effects in fish and in prawns, to stop using our sewage farms as a way of getting rid of rubbish, you know, flushing things down the toilet. There is so much that we can all do, but it is a very, very big problem that is going to need an awful lot of work to resolve it.
Yeah, Marianne, we should also talk about the impacts of humans on this huge accumulation of chemicals. And we're, of course, drinking water with all those little plastic beads in them, the microscopic beads that we deposit in from our toothpaste, yep, and many other cosmetic products. But then they get into our water, and we're taking them in as well. They're accumulating faster and faster, and we're also having more sort of reproductive problems. That is, people who find themselves unable to conceive for one reason or another. And this is just the beginning of it, it seems to me, unless we do something very radical.
I agree. And truly, when we realize that every baby on this earth is now born with quite often up to a couple of hundred different chemicals in its umbilical cord blood, that should have been enough to shock the globe into waking up. But unfortunately, it hasn't. And so all of us carry our body load of chemicals. We already have associated those body loads for people with high exposure. For example, Inuit people with high POPs in their body have an increased cardiovascular disease, increased high cholesterol levels, diabetes, inflammatory chronic diseases, cancer. So we do have a link between those exposures. Much of those exposures come through food, and a lot of that comes through fish and marine foods, which, as we know, are already contaminated. But yes, there is no question or doubt that the chemicals we are exposed to are having their effect. We're passing them on to the next generation. Every time a mother breastfeeds, unfortunately, we give our firstborn life history of chemicals. And the only way we can address that is to A, get rid of chemicals that are bioaccumulative and persistent. And we have long argued that if you find a chemical in a baby's body, in a baby's umbilical cord blood, it has no right to be on the commercial market. Unfortunately, we have not won with that argument. And we see more and more, for example, the PFAS chemicals. I think we now have something like 4,700 of them on the market, yet we probably have data on less than 20, 25 of them. So we don't know how bioaccumulative, how persistent, or how toxic many of those chemicals are. And that's something we've argued for a long time. If there's no data on a chemical, then there should be no market for that chemical.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talking to Marianne Lloyd-Smith, who's developed a huge amount of expertise on the chemical pollutants that are concentrating in the ocean and in our bodies. Marianne Lloyd, it seems to me that getting all these chemicals out of the ocean is almost inconceivable. There's so much water, and they're there, and many of them don't decompose in a very long period or not at all. The POPs that you've written about, persistent organic pollutants. On land, it seems to me, though, we have a somewhat better chance of getting water and food, greatly reducing the amount of chemicals that we're bathed in through regenerative agriculture, through not using any of those chemicals, like biological efforts to bacteria that eat some of the chemicals, and also organic agriculture of various kinds.
Oh, I certainly think we can do a lot. And as you say, regenerative farming, which, you know, sequesters carbon, restores soil health, and by doing that, it can protect runoff to rivers and oceans. So that certainly is a major thing people can do. We can also look at the types of ecosystem approaches to aquaculture as well. And there's some very interesting work where we've seen open water integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, which simply means having fish farms and seaweed production at the same time growing together so you don't produce waste. Very similar to the sort of principles on which regenerative farming is based. We've also got some wonderful initiatives with circular economy. And I don't mean, you know, the circular economy that industry talks about, which means burning everything at the end, but it's a true circular economy, so that when you produce a product, you know what its life cycle will be. you know what will happen to the end of that, to that product at the end of its life, and it will come back into the circular economy as a form of resource for another product. But to do that, to have a truly circular economy, you have to detoxify it. But because there is absolutely no point in recycling plastic to make new plastic products or recycling other things if they are full of toxic chemicals. And that's exactly what's happened today. When we tested children's toys, we found chemicals in them that should never have been there, and we couldn't work out why until we realized that many of those toys had been made from plastics that had been used in electronics, so were contaminated with brominated flame retardants. So really, to have true economy, circular economy, you have to get rid of the toxics. To get rid of the toxics, we need to get rid of the demand for them, because that's industry's excuse all the time. We only produce what people want, which is absolute rubbish. You know, they produce what they want to sell and give people the least choices possible. And so as consumers and community people, we have to say, no, we will not buy those products. We will not accept that. It's a hard fight. It's a fight that we've been working on now for probably 35, 40 years, and as many, many other community groups across the globe are. But, you know, we can do a lot, and we must do a lot. Otherwise, we're going to leave a very sad and degraded world to our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, and it has to be done fairly quickly, too, because climate change is going to kill all of us if it's not very rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have to nourish hope and make demands. At some point, in fact, people are going to wake up, especially to climate change, when Long Island goes underwater and many other places go underwater, and food prices begin spiking and all of the rest, vast fires and droughts. They will wake up. We have to be prepared. We have to do everything we can now, and partly in preparation for that moment when people arise, a huge mobilization, which will, of course, displace our current elites, who will be relegated to rest homes of some kind to contemplate what they've done to the planet. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 30th Monday. Later in our program, Johanna Brenner interviews Catherine Sammy about her recently published book, Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. But next we turn to Sarah Summerhill. She's our Old Mole intern from Washington State University, and she's here to reflect on the coronavirus pandemic, climate change emergency, and the use of this time as an opportunity to find new and creative ways to come together.
Social distancing is a phrase that has undoubtedly planted itself and bloomed in the minds of everyone listening over the past few weeks. It's a phrase that requires no definition, but not one I, or many others, were familiar with until COVID-19 began making its way across the globe and causing worldwide panic in a pandemic. As hard as I've tried to love it, when I see the phrase written up before me right now, I picture myself alone in my home for the next 6 weeks, slowly spiraling down into a physical, deep, dark pit, muggy waters fading my surroundings, and a clenching feeling wedged into the back of my throat and in my heart. The phrase reminds me of a feeling my generation has grappled with for far too many years now on an ever-growing upward curve. Eco-anxiety. The insistent fear of global human extinction, the sweaty palms and minds that come with the never-ending depictions of thick, blood-red oil resisting the turquoise waters of the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. A sooty, smoky society ruined by Chernobyl in 1986, and blankets and bodies of fish, whales, sea lions, or seals covering the world's beaches adorned with broken glass bottles and random, unidentifiable pieces of plastic. I don't know about you, but I've never looked a tiger in the eye. Not a lion either, or a cougar, or a flesh-eating fish. The closest I've come to being eaten by any kind of vicious creature was a spider in my bathroom last summer that my dad thought might have been a brown recluse. Yeah, I've got that instinct, like everyone else. Fight or flight, that inherent freeze or jump run screen that grabs hold of my body when I think I might be in danger. That instinct is supposed to keep me safe, but causes more trouble than I sometimes think it's worth. I often wish that feeling away would do anything to be free of its grip, now in the midst of a pandemic more than ever. In the moments where clarity is on my side, I think of a lesser known scene than the one with the apricot in the film Call Me By Your Name. What lies ahead is going to be very difficult, Elio's father relates to his son from the intimate setting of their couch. In your place, if there's pain, nurse it, and if there's a flame, don't snuff it out, don't be brutal with it. We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster than we should that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start with someone new. But to feel nothing so as not to feel anything, what a waste. While Dr. Perlman may have been relating the topic to his son's sexual discovery, I can't help but think of his words each time I'm searching for certainty in an uncertain world. Many will argue, in an attempt to cage us down, that what we do doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Though they speak truth, radical social change is required for our issues to have widespread impact. Activism is more than a push for change in the world. It is often a change within ourselves to see the world we live in at its rawest, with all the awful truths, but also all of the wonderful good. Often, when faced with seemingly nonstop adversity, it's all we can do to keep ourselves from falling between the cracks. That change sustains our movements. We can do nothing or we can do something. The outcome may remain the same, but in the latter option, the least we have is hope, and the most we have is a better world for ourselves and those we love. To be young and to be an activist lowers our status in many respects. When we ask for understanding, our words are distorted in the well mouths of politicians. When we fight for help, we are handed empty promises and stolen speeches, then put on the back burner of the print presses that stamp out mint green dollar bills out of splinted trees we hold in our hands. We show love and nothing but, and we are given in return sprays of glacial, tarnished water, lacrimator gases, and violence. And yet activists will be. The feeling of fear wallows inside of us when day turns to night and little good news comes our way. But the anxiety, as awful as it is not useless. While it paralyzes us for a moment, while sadness washes over us and holds us beneath the water, tides always go out eventually, and we may push back against the gravity which forms those waves. We band together. Creeks and streams converging to form rivers ready to take on oceans. That feeling of fear stems from the innate human desire to survive, and we can unleash it the way forces of nature are meant to be freed. Some have deemed coronavirus a wake-up call, proof that society cannot continue in the same binding monetary systems which pen us in, turn our blood to wires, and our flesh to machines of metal. Many may find themselves with a sudden surge in blank space, free time they must fill. What would it be like if we took time to feel ourselves? To feel all that's been pushed to the back burner for a 9-to-5 work life balanced with steady social lives? If we took this time for curiosity, allowed our sadness to come out and play, to find what agendas push it onto us. With the outbreak of coronavirus comes the push for social distancing, which puts the necessary human connection in a bit of a bind. But I see people continuing to help each other in this time of need. Now more than ever, we must come together during a time in which the world is calling for us to stay apart. Forces of destruction do not take pause during emergencies like pandemics, and we may feel helpless and unable to make a difference while physically confined. Right now, we must protect our most vulnerable, flatten the curve, and help the most people that we can. It feels as if we must sit and wait. But the world hasn't stopped moving. Seasons continue to change. Snow melts, and every day, creeks and rivers begin rushing deeper in preparation for spring and summer. Now is the time to build our energy reserves, collect potential, and prepare to unleash it when we are able. This time is our winter, and we are in hibernation, but we are not sleeping the time away. While we take a pause from the systems which confine us for most of our lives, let us breathe the idea of a world where people are connected through human need, through water, space, and love, rather than through forced organizations of destruction. Let us take down the dams and let water flow freely for a bit. Let us see where new streams and rivers develop.
nothing left to lose. I'm so high it makes my brain whirl. Drop my cell phone down below. Ain't that just like me?
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, community radio. Thanks for all who continue to support us during these strange and difficult times. And, of course, I want to thank again the dedicated KBOO staff members who have spent the last few weeks keeping amazing radio on the air for our community. Thank you from the Old Mole Collective. We really appreciate everything you're doing. Well, we conclude our show this morning with Johanna Brenner and Catherine Sammy talking about her recently published book, Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. Catherine Sammy is Assistant Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of California, Irvine, and both Catherine and Johanna have been longtime members and contributors to the Old Mole. We're happy to have them back today, Catherine and Johanna.
Catherine Sammy, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Johanna. Thank you so much.
I'm so excited to be interviewing you about your new book, Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders, just published this year by University of Washington Press. I thought we would start by having you talk a little bit about how you came to write this book about Iranian women rights activists.
Sure. Well, a big part of this history includes you. You and I, along with Catherine Tetrick, opened a wonderful feminist bookstore in 1993. And I had been out of college for a few years. And just through the bookstore, actually, and, you know, I mean, I considered myself an activist and scholarly person, so trying to keep up with a lot of feminist literature. And I started reading about Islamic feminism in Iran, and because my father's from Iran, I'm Iranian-American, I became extremely interested in what scholars like Liba Mir Hosseini and Valentine Mogadam were calling Islamic feminism, and just decided that that's something that I wanted to pursue in terms of my research. So the book is a kind of result of many years of thinking about questions of gender and Islam, about feminist activism both in Iran and transnationally. As someone who's done a lot of activism myself, I really am interested in thinking about the intimate and everyday labors of activism and activists, particularly as they navigate very difficult local, transnational, geopolitical circumstances. So that's part of how the book came into being. My father is from Iran. He came to the U.S. long before the revolution in the 60s and wasn't planning to stay, but met my mom, had me. And I remember growing up during the 1979 revolution, watching him watch that with great pride. So in my family, the revolution was, and my uncle, you know, was an activist in Iran. The revolution was not sort of a dirty word. Now, of course, things that have happened since the revolution are very complicated, but I have always been interested in thinking about the revolution and this post-revolutionary moment. So those are some of the reasons.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that you mention the revolution. And I should say your book really focuses on stories of women activists. The first chapter in the book focuses on a collective subject, the women active in what was called the 1 million signatures campaign. And then the other chapters tell the stories of two really remarkable women who were active in Iran, one Shireen Abadi and the other Mahbubeh Abbasgolizadeh.
Very good.
Thank you. And I think telling their stories in terms of both how they kind of do their activism and what the politics of their activism is very compelling. And one of the things that was interesting is that for many of the women who you profile, they were part of the revolution. They were part of the revolutionary generation. And it's interesting just to see how their politics evolved from out of being part of a revolution that had so much hope, but that was also very classical for those of us who were in the left in those years in terms of the kinds of thinking that went on in the revolution.
Absolutely. You know, Iran is such an incredibly rich example of exploring how is it that in these collective moments and sort of in the aftermath of these collective moments, women and others, other marginalized groups, their particular concerns get traded away for the good of the collective of the nation. And this certainly happened in Iran. So I try to explore the ways in which, through these stories, as you say, many of the women negotiated that the gains and losses of the revolution and the particular commitments that they maintained to, we might say, a post-colonial nation, but also were able to critique the repression of many post-revolutionary governments and moments that we've seen in the last 40 years. They were able to critique that and in some ways try to hold the state in all its complexity accountable to the sort of promises of the revolution. So I think the stories gave me an opportunity to explore some of those complexities, because when we think about or talk about Iran, it's often in two ways, particularly those of us who are leftist or progressive. So one is to defend it because of it's imbricated in a geopolitical structure in which it's framed as backwards and irrational and theocratic, etc. We get positioned in these places where we feel like we have to defend it, or we critique it wholly and think about things like, oh yes, we need sanctions because they can target these repressive leaders. And I wanted to tell a more complicated story about how people in Iran and outside of Iran who define themselves as part of a what I think of as a kind of beloved community of feminist activists could actually articulate a more complex politics in which they could call out the problems of their society and also resist the kinds of dangerous interventions on their behalf.
Right, exactly. And this is one of the things that you talk about, I think, so eloquently in the book, is that you want to challenge this idea that's so prevalent and still pretty widespread in the West, and particularly among even Western feminists, that Iranian women are solely or primarily victims and not agents. They're not seen as not only being capable of struggling on their own, but actually have much to teach people in the women in the West about how to think about some of these questions. And in particular, I would say, to challenge this dualism of secularism versus religion, and particularly Islam, that rationality and human rights reside with secularism, and that religion is necessarily antithetical to women's freedom.
Absolutely, yes, you're so right to pick up on the challenging dualisms, and that's one of the major dualisms I try to think through, you know, with other scholars who are doing that same kind of work, to, yes, say that this notion that rights reside in the West and in the Western subject, and that religion or culture reside in the non-Western subject, and that religion, culture, particularly these global South or non-Western cultures, are inherently backward, irrational, mm-hmm. and that secularism, democratic ideas, etc., are inherently reside in the West. And we just know this is not true. I think our current moment is teaching us all a lot of lessons about the fact that there are no natural, essential rights-bearing subjects. Rights are something that mm-hmm. we all, no matter where we are, have to continually fight for and negotiate. So I really did want to explore and really challenge that particular binary between religion and culture and rights, to look at how Iranian feminists, through their discourses, through their practices, through their campaigns, locate rights inside of their own context and really talk about and think about how they can fight for their rights, and that their societies offer them the discourses, the practices to do so, that they don't have to look elsewhere necessarily. So that's definitely one dualism that I wanted to challenge, and there are several that I think I try to challenge in the book too. One speaks to what we just talked about, this idea that you either have a anti-imperialist stand that doesn't hold your own state accountable, or that you have to intervene on behalf of Iranians in dangerous kinds of ways. So,
right.
So yeah, that is a theme throughout the book. How do activists and citizens manage and articulate and practice these kinds of complexities?
Great. Let me take a moment here to let people know, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Johanna Brenner. I'm interviewing Catherine Sammy, who's author of the book Axis of Hope, and we're talking about Iranian women's rights activism. Catherine, talk a little bit more about this point that you just made, about the ways in which Iranian women's activists have been able to articulate a feminism within the context of Islam rather than as something that comes from outside of it.
Sure. Well, one of the stories in the book is kind of a case study of the 1 Million Signatures campaign, which emerges in 2006 after a kind of shift rightward of the state in terms of parliament and the presidency. And this campaign emerges to challenge the discriminatory legal structure in Iran. So things like laws around marriage, divorce, inheritance, citizenship, etc. And the campaign really, as I say in the book, it is in conversation with the kind of post-revolutionary state to say that, look, it doesn't make sense to have a discriminatory legal structure in a society that has improved the well-being and the life circumstances of women through higher rates of literacy. Literacy rates shot way up in the decades following the revolution because of the opening of free universities. Yes, many of those universities were Islamic universities. Nonetheless, they educated many, many women and others. People learned to read and got educations in ways they didn't in the pre-revolutionary period under the Shah. Okay. Women's fertility went from 7 point something in 1979 to around 2. So many, many circumstances and things improved for women. So this campaign argued, look, you have a society that has taken women seriously. We see women participating in education and in public life, and it doesn't make sense to have a discriminatory legal structure. So Islam is not against women's rights and women's rights in the family and women's education and women's equality. And so this campaign worked with and drew on the work and scholarship of many reform clerics who became very vocal when Khatami was president and things were a little bit more open. So worked with and drew on their ideas that there's nothing inherently patriarchal in the discourse of Islam, that this is a discursive tradition that's open to many different kinds of interpretations, and that, as many scholars argue, in all religions, that we need to recognize the flexibility of religion to accommodate contemporary circumstances. So the women in the 1 Million Signatures campaign really argued that the contemporary circumstances of women's incorporation, active incorporation into a society that was doing many good things for its citizens, needed to be reflected in law, in the family law.
Right. I was found very inspiring the ways in which they organized, that so many women participated. It was a very participatory and democratic kind of movement, I thought.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is one of the things in the book. I'm in some ways also trying to give this moment in Iran's history and sort of Iranian feminist history a kind of place in the global right. Trend of these networked horizontal movements that are partly on the ground and partly online. So, you know, initially activists were going door to door. They were doing street theater. They were talking to their neighbors and their coworkers and trying to get signatures, trying to get a million signatures, which they would then, from that, draft a bill that they would turn into parliament to overturn some of the discriminatory laws. So, yeah, it was really such an interesting campaign because it drew on some of the, you know, what we can think of as Iranian cultural modes of hospitality and collegiality and discussion to educate people and to talk to people and to think together about women's rights, and also to draw on things that people were also, in a sense, taking for granted, that yes, women's equality is an important part of a strong society that is taking care of its citizens. Right. So the practices and methods, both sort of on the ground and then online, were really interesting. And I talk in the book about the Iranians living outside of Iran who became active in the campaign because of this loose kind of horizontal structure. And we can see that structure then in, of course, you know, Occupy and the Arab uprisings, you know, Me Too, many of the movements that are both on the ground but also highly mediated.
We're almost out of time, but I did just want to mention that one of your activists, Mahbube, she was in New York City during the time of Occupy, and she established a streaming TV show there that was a feminist TV show for Iranians.
Yeah, it was a streaming television channel called Zenon TV, which means women's TV, basically. And she launched it right in the heart of the Occupy movement. And that, for me, was so moving to think about the kinds of coalitions and affiliations that she was gesturing towards in that moment. And she says at this launching that she's here to occupy space mm-hmm. in the Occupy movement and to bring some of the things that she learned as an activist in Iran to this movement. And I talk a lot in the book about her feeling, she was exiled from Iran at that point and feeling kind of sad and had a lot of sure. kind of post-trauma. And it's at that moment that she feels like this connection to her fellow activists and citizens of the world. And so it was a very moving project, and she's an incredible activist.
Yeah, I loved reading about her. Well, Catherine, we're out of time, but I want to say again, thank you for being with us today. This is Johanna Brenner. I've been talking to Catherine Sammy, who's the author of Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. It's a wonderful book. And Catherine, best of luck and good fortune. I hope many, many people will read this terrific book.
Thanks so much, Johanna.
Bye.
Bye-bye. رفتار ما با ستاب دید و تفکر ماست دید و تفکر یک انتخابه تنها انتخابی که هر روز و هر لحظه آزادانه دست خود ماست.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7, listener-supported community radio. Thanks to KBOO staff for sticking it out and making this all happen for our community. I want to thank our guests this morning because, indeed, it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m., and we're going to keep making that happen. Johanna Brenner and Catherine Sammy, Bill Resnick, Marianne Lloyd-Smith, and our fabulous intern, Sarah Summerhill. And remember that you can find us on the web, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. This show and an archive of past shows dating back many years, many subjects, many turmoils, and the many creative solutions and pathways to that better world we seek. I'm Denise Morris. We'll see you back again here next Monday.